Welcome to Insider's Guide to Energy Stories. We hope you enjoy finding out more about the personal journeys of your colleagues and their journey through the energy industry. Now, sit back and enjoy this week's episode.
This episode of Insider's Guide to Energy Stories is sponsored by Vedectus. For more information, please go to www.vedectus.com.
Welcome to a new episode of Insider's Guide to Energy Stories. Today, I'm really pleased to say that I've got Sharon Mustry alongside me. Sharon, would you introduce yourself for the audience, please?
Hi, well, yeah. I'm Sharon. I work at Bloomberg NEF doing research broadly on batteries, battery supply chains, and then also how to decarbonize industry.
Okay, fantastic. Batteries, in my work as a power market researcher, I know that batteries are kind of becoming quite a hot thing. What specifically within batteries and battery supply chains are you looking at, if it gets more specific than that?
Yeah, so at Bloomberg NEF, we look at kind of everything from the raw materials that go into it, how they're extracted, to how the batteries are used in different applications, whether it's in EVs or within power markets. I look more on the upstream side of that. So looking at what kinds of materials go into it, how the markets for those materials then interact with what battery chemistries become more or less attractive. And then we work very closely with other people that look at the technologies themselves, the chemistries themselves. So it's kind of like the lines get blurred between teams, but I tend to be focused more on the upstream side of things.
Okay, that's really interesting. So I wonder, you know, maybe you've always been interested in batteries, or maybe it was a kind of development. How did you end up in the sort of battery space?
Yeah, I think if I go way back, I studied economics, and my favorite class in economics was one that did environmental economics. And that's where I realized, like, oh, actually the part that I really cared about was the environment. But economics was a really useful lens to see kind of why a lot of problems we were having with the environment were occurring. So I continued on the economics route, but I also started looking a lot into energy. And then once I started doing research at Bloomberg NEF, I joined a team that focused on battery supply chains. So that's how I came to batteries. But before that, I used to be kind of quite broadly focused on environmental and energy research. There wasn't any kind of reason why I would have preferred batteries over other technologies.
Right. Gotcha. And if I understand correctly, so you studied economics, but you also did some philosophy before that. Is that right?
Yeah. I studied at Berkeley, and they have a really good philosophy department. So just took like a class in my first year, and I loved it, so I kept going with it.
Okay, nice. So were you doing the economics and the philosophy sort of in tandem while you were there?
Yeah, they're like two separate degrees. It was a really cool university in the sense that it's really free. So I was able to do those two things. There was no energy program for undergrad, but I could take like graduate level classes for energy and for environmental things. And then I also ended up doing stuff related to data science. So it was really cool to kind of have the freedom to explore whatever interests you wanted to.
Yeah. No, that does sound good. I'm interested in something you said a moment ago about what economics can do for the environment. I'm interested to get your take as an economist. You know, what role does economics have in supporting the environment, in fighting climate change, those kind of issues?
Right. I mean, I think that's honestly the heart of the issue today, right? So we have the technologies. There's some things that we need to sort out in terms of how to implement them, how to make renewables have the flexibility we want them to have, how to integrate everything. But besides those issues, which are kind of engineering issues, there's a really big question of how we're going to structure how we value the services being provided by different technologies, what the cost should be. And then more broadly, when you speak about kind of the problem of climate change, what we should price in or not, in terms of kind of externalities into our economic system. So I've come across a lot of interesting versions of people trying to solve this problem. Obviously, the one that economists love is just a carbon tax, you know, theoretically the easiest one to implement, but then comes all of these things like social implications, political implications that you also look into when you're doing economics. I think economics basically plays a role of the incentive, no? And if we figure out how to structure what we value and what we price into our economy, then it'll be easier to either shift into some forms of energy versus others. So yeah, it's very intertwined with the technological struggle.
That's a good answer. That's very interesting. I think it's an interesting point you make that it's perfect in theory. So I wondered if you could talk about where that theory breaks down. Where economics and the pricing of all our externalities might not work.
Right. So I think probably the biggest fault or the biggest struggle would in the implementation of something like a carbon tax is that generally for it to work, it would have to be kind of a global thing. And reaching that level of consensus on anything is practically impossible. So there has to be, if you implement it at a regional level, in a way, there's some systems that approximate it, like in Europe or in California, then you have to think about how that affects further downstream the industry. So if you're taxing some forms of technology, I don't know, at the generation level, how that affects direct consumers, perhaps industry, that will then have a hard time competing globally because their costs have gone up. So if you then price it kind of at the industry level, it's the same thing. The way kind of a lot of our commodities are intertwined with carbon means that if you price carbon, it'll very quickly have impacts throughout the entire economy because it's tied to so many of like the building blocks of our materials or kind of the raw inputs into a lot of the products and services of the world.
Yeah, I suppose that there's carbon in, you know, coal and gas, and then there's carbon in steel, and it's
exactly
the fuel you use to make steel, and then it's in cement as well, and it's
just in everything practically.
Basically everything.
Even,
isn't it?
You know, I mean, we're using the internet right now to talk. There's carbon embedded in that, you know, like anything that uses energy is going to have carbon.
Yeah. So I guess some of the unintended impacts that you might have relate to things like fuel poverty. You know, if you raise carbon prices, then you could price people out of heating during the winter. Is that the kind of thing that you mean?
Right. That could be one unintended consequence. And you could also talk about that at a global scale, right? So if you have to get this global consensus to price carbon, then there's some kind of debate under which kind of more developing countries feel they've gotten the short end of the stick, because in a way they haven't contributed as much to the problem historically as other countries. Say the typical example is the UK, because of the Industrial Revolution. Historically, they have the highest emissions. So it's, in a way, it seems unfair for everyone to pay the same carbon tax when not everyone contributed to the problem in the same way. But when you have, you know, we know we have a carbon budget, we're very strict about the physics around that. So, and we don't have that much time to solve the problem. So it becomes complicated to have to deal with the nuances of what's right, you know, like you could say it's actually right that these developing countries get to develop and don't have to kind of invest in very high capex technologies to continue to have energy and have to restructure a lot of their systems just to fit, like help solve this problem that they historically didn't contribute.
That they haven't created.
Yeah.
I suppose there's definitely an argument that countries that haven't contributed to climate change have a right to develop economically right. and energy-wise the same way that other countries which have created the problem did.
Exactly. And the exact same thing happens at a local scale, right? So, for example, in the US, there's a lot of, I think it tends to be kind of more underprivileged communities that you have to end up convincing that, yeah, they should sacrifice, you know, I don't know if sacrifice is the right word, but they should take kind of they should make effort to make a change for something that they don't really understand, like carbon budgets and stuff like that, and perhaps like have to use less heat or less air conditioning, change the way they live, all the comforts we've become used to. That's not to say that, I mean, in some cases it can be done without a lot of sacrifice, like I said, but some people are just completely kind of opposed to the idea of having to change their lifestyle because of this problem, no matter where they are in the world.
Right. So I think the conclusion you could come to is that it's an extremely complicated problem. Trying to sort of solve all our environmental issues. Do you think economics alone is the answer, or do you think that there's a role for just straight up sort of regulation and banning of things, for example?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think in how we're pricing everything currently, economics couldn't be an answer at all. Policy is incredibly intertwined with the economics of energy today. In fact, I'm originally from Mexico. I know a lot of our fossil fuels get subsidized. Without that, then, you know, if you remove the subsidy, a lot of people will complain about it, probably namely industry. But at the same time, you've already kind of messed with the pure economics of the fuel itself. Plus, you're not pricing in the externalities of carbon emissions. So, I mean, in itself, the system as it is now, that wouldn't probably change much. The only argument you could make is that technologies like solar, wind are coming down in prices, and the economics of that are favorable in a lot of places. But no, I think ultimately policy is going to end up having a huge role. And beyond policy, also kind of education and the way we do marketing around these topics. It's hard to convince a whole world to kind of care about something like this and to actually change their behavior, which is a hard part.
Yeah, it is indeed. Is there a kind of popular movement or policy to support a kind of clean energy transition in Mexico at the moment, or is the status quo accepted currently?
That's quite a controversial topic, actually. Okay. In terms of like a popular movement, there's a few. There's a lot of people that care about protecting the environment, because it is a country full of biodiversity, and there's a lot of. I mean, we have also like an incredibly, like, beautiful, rich culture tied to that biodiversity, namely through indigenous populations. So there's a lot that has been going on the ground to protect the environment. In terms of politicians themselves, it's quite controversial because the policy is often tied to kind of Mexico's state energy companies, both for electricity and for oil. And that ends up kind of skewing the incentives of politicians. So there's a lot of questions that they end up taking into account that maybe if you look at it purely from an environmental sense, you wouldn't necessarily care about it. But obviously national security, but also the kind of the security of these really big companies that they've invested a lot of money into, and making sure that they continue to run and continue to depend a bit less on government subsidies, which today they depend a lot on that. So
yeah,
it's a bit complicated.
Yeah. And I guess aside from anything, just from a citizen's point of view, anyone would be supportive of cheaper bills, right? If you to heat your home, right, cool your home, as it might be, if that's cheaper, then that's a great thing, isn't it? So I imagine it's in ways it's politically popular to sort of subsidize these things. And
of course it'll be very hard. Actually, our current president, that was one of the things he was running on, was like cheaper basics. So electricity and kind of fuel costs was part of that. Also like gasoline. He promised that the prices of all of those kind of very basic items would not increase, and if possible, even decrease during his term.
Right.
So.
Yeah. And I imagine that Mexico is one of those countries that historically hasn't contributed that much in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. In the grand scheme of things, at least, it's not going to be a major contributor.
No, it's more like a mid-range kind of country.
Right.
But yeah, right. It still has a lot of work to do. It can. I believe it can do better.
Okay. Yeah. Well, yeah, I think most countries can do a lot better currently. Yeah. There's a long way to
go. Mean, something that's also interesting about Mexico is that it was really successful with kind of renewable energy auctions, and it had some of the cheapest costs for technologies like solar and I think even wind just a few years ago. But a lot of that was kind of halted with the new presidency, and it's unclear which direction it'll be going in the next few years. But yeah, it definitely slowed down all kinds of like renewable energy activity.
Yeah. Oh, that's really interesting. I didn't know that about Mexico. I guess for solar, the fact that it's really sunny makes sense.
Exactly.
But I didn't know it was a windy place as well.
Yeah, it's windy in kind of the southeast, the tip. So a lot of people know Mexico for Cancun. It's like near that area.
Okay, interesting. So on to your work in batteries. I'm quite interested in that. Do you focus on the American market or is it worldwide?
It's worldwide. So my focus, it's shifted few times, but I think if I had to say, like, there's one thing I focused on within batteries was lithium production, which tends to happen either in South America or Australia. And then it's refined in a couple other countries like China, the US. But it's when you talk about supply chains for batteries, it's a really, really interesting topic because it changes, I want to say almost month to month, but it changes really quickly and really drastically too. So in the last few years that I've been working on the topic, kind of, for example, in terms of global coverage, Europe came online and said, we want to do lithium too. You know, we want regional supply chains, we want sustainable supply chains. And then of course, if you look at lithium prices, that's also a whole other story, which is really important because it incentivizes different kinds of extraction. And therefore, if you go towards more unconventional methods, that unlocks more global supply chains versus just kind of the traditional forms of extraction that are only really viable in certain regions.
Okay. So I'm hoping you can clear up something that I've been sort of wondering for a while. And I've seen some conflicting sort of news stories about lithium and whether the world's going to run out of it or not. I think I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, that there are only, it sounds like as well from what you're saying, that there are only a few places in the world where you can get conventional, where you can conventionally sort of find lithium. And I think I went and visited the desert in Chile, the Atacama Desert.
Wow, so cool.
And I was on the salt flats, and I think that that's an area where the world gets a lot of its lithium from. It was an amazing region. Yeah, like nothing else I've ever seen, to be honest. And Australia, as you say. Is that correct?
Yeah, so in terms of the conventional kind of lithium mining, there's two kinds. So the first is through brines with solar evaporation, and that really only happens today, mostly in Chile and then a little bit in Argentina, or a substantial amount in Argentina, but it's dominated by Chile. Then there's another kind of lithium, which is called spodumene, and it's found in hard rock. So it's more of the traditional kind of mining that you think of when you think of mines. And that's traditionally done in Australia. And often it's literally only mined in Australia and then shipped to China to be refined. Whereas in South America, they have also the refining kind of on site. That's changing. So Australia is trying to go downstream and refine on site too, and that'll probably change in the next couple of years with the first refineries coming online. But that being said, I mean, there's a lot of lithium even in those two countries. China also has lithium mines. The US also has a couple that are conventional, but it's mostly dominated by Chile and Australia. When it comes to unconventional lithium, it'll require some more creativity. So there's one kind which is called clay, and it's relatively similar to hard rock lithium. And that's found in the Western US mostly, which is quite convenient, especially if you're a company like Tesla, right? You have lithium literally a state away, and pretty nice.
Yeah, that is handy.
and then a little bit of clays in the north of Mexico too. Then there's oil field brines, which are found today, the ones that have been explored in Calgary in Canada, and also in the US, kind of in the border between Texas and Arkansas. I don't know how many people here have like a map of the US in their mind, but maybe that helps. Northern Texas, Southern Arkansas.
Yeah.
And there's a project there actually in Arkansas called Standard Lithium that's quite interesting. It's pretty innovative. But once you go into those kinds of brines, you have to be creative in terms of how you partner with other companies to make it viable. For example, Standard Lithium partnered with a bromine producer, so they didn't have to pay for all the capex of like pumping out the brine. They just get the waste brine from this bromine plant, and then it's a lot easier of a process for them.
Yeah.
And the last one is geothermal, and that's interesting in the south of California and in Europe. So Europe is quite interested in geothermal, particularly right now in Germany, which again, very close to Tesla there, but also a bunch of other companies that are shifting towards EVs, like Daimler and like a lot of companies. So Germany is very, very keen on localizing the full supply chain. And the cool thing about things like geothermal lithium is that they have a potential to be fully net zero. Use the energy from the geothermal to power the extraction, and the extraction doesn't really use that much more besides energy and a few reagents. So, I mean, there's the embodied carbon of the reagents, but it ends up being a relatively clean process.
Yeah.
So, yeah. When you put that all together, there's no sense that we're running out of lithium, especially not at the mine level. But when you look at the refineries, we do find that there's a bit of a, like, the markets are getting a bit squished, especially because it's quite a difficult product to refine. You have to be very careful, and there's a lot of different specifications that change, often by battery supplier. Like each customer will ask for a slightly different version of lithium. So you end up having, today, like where we see the constraints in the next 5 years is more on the refining side. That being said, I think it's really, really important to think about recycling when we talk about batteries. And in BNEF's analysis, there's a sense that there might be enough batteries and enough know-how to recycle about, like, the equivalent of recycled batteries would provide about 10% of supply by the end of the decade, which is not a lot, but it's a substantial dent. But more than anything, we care about recycling because the whole point of this transition towards kind of cleaner energy is not just because of carbon, but also taking care of the environment. And ultimately, when you're talking about anything, be it ICE vehicles or EVs, they require a lot of material. So you want to be kind of as circular as possible. And yeah, those metals are like almost fully recyclable, all of them. So it'll be an interesting space to watch in the next decade.
Yeah. So technology wise, they can be recycled, sort of full stop. Is that the case?
They can. But there's a bit of nuance there. So depends where the battery is coming from first.
Okay.
It's not super clear. Like I said, each manufacturer does it slightly differently. And then there's a lot of different chemistries, right? So I'm pretty sure you need to recycle kind of the same kinds of batteries at one time. You can't combine different chemistries. I might be wrong, but from my understanding of it, that's how it works.
Okay.
So first of all, if you get a battery from an EV, it won't be fully depleted. So there's kind of an intermediate step where you might find another use for that battery. Then you take it to be recycled. There are a lot of companies working on this. We have the technology. I'm sure it can be improved a lot within the next decade. And then, yeah, essentially it's kind of a combination of heating processes and chemical processes to separate out the different elements and then reprocess them to go back into a battery.
Okay. And in terms of the demand for lithium and lithium ion batteries, is that mostly driven by electric vehicles or is it grid scale batteries as well? Like what kind of proportions are we talking here?
Yeah, it's mostly driven by electric vehicles and more as we go out into the kind of the next 10 years. I can't remember the proportion off the top of my mind, but it's definitely more than half is going to be from EVs. Okay. I want to say it's closer to like 3/4 actually. There's still not that many batteries used for energy storage. That's still kind of a market that is yet to develop at the same scale as electric vehicles.
Yeah. Okay. Very interesting. So do you see batteries as a really important enabler of climate targets?
Yes, definitely. Batteries are fascinating because there's so many things that you can flex with them in terms of they can help you power a vehicle or they can help you provide different kind of lengths of storage for the grid and for technologies like solar and wind. So they have a lot of flexibility in terms of applications. When it comes to EVs, I think they're interesting not only because you get to decarbonize transport, but also because you get these interesting dynamics of vehicle to grid and whether or not that will end up working and how that involves people like you and I. Like we might have a car and end up also contributing to balancing the grid. I never thought I would be kind of as involved in the electricity system as that through things I owned, right? When it comes to like large scale energy storage, batteries are a really key piece of the puzzle. If you want flexibility, if you want to integrate renewables, there's other forms of storage and batteries are not the only part of the puzzle. But if we are trying to get to anything close to 24/7 clean power, batteries will be part of that and increasingly more in the future. Mm. It's also, when we talk about the economics of these systems, batteries play a really important role. And we're seeing more and more kind of batteries co-located with things like wind or solar, just because it lets you provide the energy to the grid, not just when the wind is blowing or the sun is shining, but also when it's most profitable. So,
yeah,
you know, ultimately that'll change the economics for all kinds of technologies.
That's a really interesting phenomenon to me is that renewables, by being there, reduce their sort of attractiveness in terms of business model by reducing
the cannibalism.
Exactly. They reduce prices at times when they generate, and so they all sort of suffer together. Battery can help significantly with that.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Do you see lithium as being the main battery then going forwards? If we're not running out of lithium, is that the technology that's kind of here to stay?
Yeah, for now it is, especially for electric vehicles. For large-scale energy storage, there's more technologies you can look at, and there's some that are quite interesting. We started getting some questions about sodium batteries. Vanadium has always been a topic that people ask about. And then there's also things that are like flywheel batteries, like there's quite a lot of technologies. For cars, we have to rely on lithium for now, but we'll start improving them. So there's solid state versions of current lithium ion batteries that will even have better performance. And then for energy storage, I wouldn't be the expert on that. I would hope, honestly, to see more diversity. I think there might be other technologies that are better suited towards different applications. But for now, energy storage kind of gets a free ride on all the advances that's happening with lithium ion and the price cuts or cost cuts, because so many of them are going into EVs and the industry is scaling up, that it just makes sense for now for stationary storage too.
Yeah, gotcha. And I'm interested, the research that you do, whom does that inform, and you know, whom is it for?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. There's several different audiences. So one will be traders, commodity traders, that care about metals, that care about power prices. Then other players would be technology developers or the companies that are doing the extracting themselves. So anyone who's part of the supply chain will care about what's happening on either side of it that maybe they don't have as much visibility into. And then we also have a lot of players like governments who are trying to put all of this information together. It's actually a really complex problem, so they need help and as much research as they can get from other sources to have benchmarks on what's going on, what the future will look like, and how to plan. So broadly, I mean, either you're a trader in industry or you're kind of an analyst strategist that's trying to figure out what's happening in the next few years.
Yeah. Okay, that makes good sense. You obviously really know your stuff about batteries and you've been kind of deep in the research about it. But, you know, earlier when we were talking, you said that there wasn't any specific reason why batteries, but you're here in batteries and that's what you do currently. Where do you see yourself in the future? You're very passionate about the environment and about the role of economics in that. I wonder how you see your career going forwards.
That's a great question. One that I try to ask myself often. I think I still find batteries fascinating, and I think there's a lot more work I would do there. I would love to go kind of beyond the supply chain and the technologies themselves, do more work into how they're used, especially in energy markets and power markets. And ultimately with the goal of understanding where do you most need to provide flexibility and where is it most useful essentially or most needed. Beyond that, I think my motivation for going into energy was it's not an affinity or like a fascination necessarily with energy markets themselves or energy production itself, although I do think it's fascinating, but it was more on the side of climate change, right? I think this is the most fundamental problem, the thing you need to solve before anything else. And ultimately, we don't have that much time to decarbonize energy. So yeah, I would love to keep learning and doing research, but I also think I'd love to combine that with being in industry and ultimately applying all the things I know to make an impact and be the one, I guess, actively participating in the decisions and the solutions. So it's a combination. I think I really enjoy both sides of things. But we'll see where we end up.
That's cool. I guess it's one of the beauties of the industry is that there are endless opportunities to kind of do exactly what you've talked about.
And it's really tight-knit too, at least. So I worked in New York. In the US, it feels like everyone that works in energy somehow knows each other. And there's a lot of kind of support and people that get very excited about it. It's an industry that like has a lot of passion within it, which is really nice.
Yeah, I've had the same perception. I think you're right there. Yeah. All right. I'm sorry to say that we've run out of time. I've really, really enjoyed this conversation. So thank you so much for joining me, Sharon.
Thank you, Will. This is great.